Hi, Katie. It's the Latte Lounge, and we're back on air again. How are you?
I'm fine, Josephine. How are you?
Very well. So I know you've had a few health problems, but let's talk about your business. How's the Latte Lounge doing?
We've been really busy. I think last time I met you was probably the end of June, just before the summer. So we had our spa day with Liz Earle MBE at the Grove Hotel. That was amazing. And that was a very informative day with speakers, Diane Dansiebrink, who we've spoken about before, and Jane Lewis and Sam Evans. And we did it to raise money for our charity partner, the Eve Appeal. And Liz spoke for about half an hour at the beginning. It was a really fantastic day. So we learned a lot then. Loads of really amazing things have happened since. You may have heard that menopause is now going to be taught in secondary schools, which is all down to the work of Diane and her Make Menopause Matter campaign, which is just fantastic news. And obviously, Rachel McLean was instrumental in that. We have won an Empower Award for Community for Women in Business. Very excited. And we were also one of the top 10 women to watch in charity in About Time magazine. So we really, we're very
The awards are
excited.
coming
They're
in.
coming in
Oh,
thick and
yeah.
fast. We had a crazy month with the Lancet report about HRT, which we're
Yes.
going to talk about a bit later with
Good.
our guest.
Yeah.
But that because of that report, we were interviewed on Sky News and Channel 4.
Woo.
And then last night we had a Facebook Live with Diane and Sam Evans again, because on Friday it's World Menopause Day, and so we're doing a whole sort of week of World Menopause Day activities this week. So
It's so
really
exciting. Well,
busy.
that brings us on to today's guest, who
Yes.
is an extraordinary person because you're related to
I
them.
am indeed. It's Breast Cancer Awareness Month, and so who better to bring in than my own father, Professor Michael Baum, or Dad, as I like to call him. So,
Or
hello.
Mike, he called me.
Or Mike,
Can you tell
yes.
us a bit about him before we,
Well, Dad is, well, I'd like to say he's a retired breast cancer professor. I won't say how old he is, but he never stops working. And rather than give you too much information
But
about
he
him,
had, I have got his book on his new latest book on my knee.
yeah.
Can you just tell us
Well,
about
I
that?
wanted to talk about his, he's literally just published his new book. It's called The History and Mystery of Breast Cancer. And so I thought it would be a perfect time to talk about the book, but also talk about Dad's work and how it connects with, obviously, with menopause and HRT, which is something I'm obviously passionate about campaigning with, and women's health overall, bringing it all together. So welcome, Dad.
What should I call you today, Katie?
Mrs. Taylor.
Mrs. Taylor. It's my pleasure to be here, Mrs. Taylor.
So Dad, before we talk about your new book, for people that obviously don't know anything about you, go back to why you first decided, when you became a doctor, why breast cancer?
First of all, I'm a surgeon. I qualified as a general surgeon, and then later in my career, I began to specialize in breast cancer. Now, I took an interest in breast cancer. My thesis was on breast cancer, and that's 1971, when I got my higher degree. And it was just an academic interest, mainly because no one knew anything about it. Now, this is a good field to do research in when no one knows anything about it. And then what happened, my mother, who I love dearly, complained of pain in the back. And that was the first evidence that we had that she has secondaries in her skeleton from a breast cancer. And she was too modest to go to the doctor with this huge thing on growing on her breast. And she suffered terribly and died in pain. But the chemotherapy they gave her just made her worse. As if she wasn't suffering enough, the next thing that happened, she lost all her hair and she prided herself on her hair. So that kind of galvanized me. I actually became angry and I wanted to hit someone. And I decided I will make an image of breast cancer and fight breast cancer for the rest of my life. And then just on top of that, my lovely sister Linda, the youngest of the family, developed breast cancer 25 years ago. And that further galvanised me. And she had the benefits of modern treatments, which, and presented as soon as she found the lump. And so her trajectory was very different to my mother's.
And obviously it's upsetting for me to hear that, because obviously that's my grandmother and my aunt. And obviously I'm, you know, incredibly proud of all the work you've done and still do. Tell us a bit about your early work, you know, as obviously as a surgeon, but in terms of treatments and research in those days.
Coming on from that, one of the very, very first clinical trials, a clinical trial is where you compare one treatment with another in a study, and a formal comparison, one treatment with another. And one of the first trials I did was to compare chemotherapy with tamoxifen, which had recently been discovered, this is going back 1974-75, to see the outcomes, not in length of life though, but in quality of life. So in order to do that, we, my colleagues and I, developed a psychometric test for measuring quality of life. And you think, how on earth do you measure quality of life? Well, we use what's called a linear analog self-assessment, which is a 10 centimeter line. At one end is good, at the other end is bad. So pain, 0, 10. And the patient then marked on the line how she was feeling. And there were 27 domains. So we found that it made no difference to the length of life, whether they had chemotherapy or tamoxifen, but the quality of life was much better on the tamoxifen. And that was, if you like, the first punch I landed on the face of breast cancer.
So tamoxifen has been with us now since
1970s, mid-1970s.
And obviously women are still taking that today, but what else has been, you know, what other treatments have...
Well, the of greater importance is using tamoxifen as an adjuvant therapy. Now, let me explain that. Adjuvant is in addition to. So most women who come with a breast cancer will have surgery and radiotherapy, but we try to explain to women that the disease is not localized, that the majority of breast cancers probably have seedlings somewhere in the body. We're not aware of them, and they appear later on in life. Now, women need to understand this, otherwise they stop taking the treatments. Because, and that part of the problem is persuading women to adhere to the therapy. But they say it's all been taken away, and we say, well, yes, we hope so, but... And so in 1983, we published the first paper, it was in The Lancet, of what happens if you take tamoxifen for a long time, having had surgery and radiotherapy. And we found you get a 30% reduction in mortality.
Fantastic.
And that has now been confirmed. I think just a few weeks ago, there was big news that there has been a something like a 60% fall in mortality from breast cancer since the 1980s. And at least half of that is thanks to taking tamoxifen after the at the time of surgery.
Fantastic.
What does taking it for a long time mean? More than how many years?
That's a good question.
Yeah.
how long is a long time? Well, we started off 2 years. Now, why 2 years? I can't even remember. It seemed a good idea at the time. And it worked, and it was good. So we thought maybe longer is better. So 2 years was compared with 5 years. 5 years was better than 2 years. Then I was part of a multinational group that compared 5 years with 10 years, and 10 years was better than... So at the moment, I'm not sure.
Well, can I ask what the side effects of taking it are?
That's the very important question. Mm. Are there side effects? Yes. Now, the way of measuring the severity of side effects is to see how many women stopped taking it because of side effects. Mm-hmm. And in all our studies, it was about 10 to 15% the side effects were sufficient to make them stop this. But they're real. So, many women get hot flushes. Mm-hmm. Many women notice thinning of the hair. Some women get what we call polyarthralgia, which is aches and pains in the small. Yeah. And yes, so the answer to that is, can we find other drugs which are less toxic that will do the same? And we have another drug, another group of drugs, which in the year 2001, we presented the results of a new trial for postmenopausal women, though, not for premenopausal, comparing tamoxifen with another class of compound. They're called aromatase inhibitors. Don't worry what that means. It effectively switches off the production of estrogen in postmenopausal women. Now, after the menopause, the estrogens aren't made by the ovary, but they're made by in the fat tissue. So, and that is less toxic and a little bit more effective. Now, I know as a result of this, I'm anticipating the questions that will come with HRT, you will then say, oh, well, that's evidence that estrogens cause breast cancer. And we'll come to that when we talk about HRT. Mm. Estrogens don't cause breast cancer, but we'll come back to that in a minute. Mm.
We will get on to that, but just before I sort of move further on, talk to me about chemo, because obviously chemo is very is upsetting.
And why do people still have it?
Because it's very effective. Mm. Yes, it's toxic. Mm. Now, we were talking about this in the car. Mm. I'm a passionate believer in that the statisticians and epidemiologists provide data for large groups. Mm. But the doctor at the coalface has to apply that to the individual. Mm-hmm. How do they do that? Mm-hmm. Well, we've come up with decision aids. And there is an excellent decision aid, which is on the web. It's called Predict NHS. It was developed by Professor Sir David Spiegelhalter. And it's fantastic. You feed in all the details about the woman and the cancer, and it comes up with, in absolute numbers, I'm going to cough, excuse me. thank you.
Yeah.
How much extra chance of living 10 years do I get if I take the chemotherapy to trade off against the toxicity of the drugs? Mm. And remember, they're given six to 12 months, so it's not a lifetime threat. And it may be 1% at 10 years. And some women will say, oh, that's not worth the toxicity. Mm. Others will say, even 1%. Mm-hmm. But these are value judgments that doctors can't make. It's the individual. Mm-hmm. So what we're trying to do is individualise treatment decisions based on large-scale studies by epidemiologists and clinical scientists.
And it's so important talking about individualized treatment. We talk about it all the time on the Facebook group and at various events, that we can't just look at an individual and, you know, it's the same treatment for everybody. Everyone has got to be treated individually. And that does bring me on a little bit to HRT, because this report in The Lancet, well, maybe you tell everyone about the report in The Lancet, which brought us to try and shut the noise down, you know, on Sky News last week or last month. I can't remember now when it was.
There was a paper from an Oxford group headed up by very famous, highly recognised expert epidemiologist who looked at all the available data. And I'm not even going to challenge the methodology. It's accepted at face value and came up with the number of extra breast cancers you get if you take HRT. And if it was combined HRT, 10 years later on, there's an extra one in 50 women will get breast cancer. If it's estrogen alone, it's one in every 200. Now, I would challenge those numbers, but let's take them at their face value. So the incidence goes up. But the important thing is, it's nothing about mortality. And outcome measures for the individual patient are length of life and quality of life. That's why we practice medicine, to improve length of life and quality of life. Now, the idea that an increased incidence of breast cancer automatically means an increase in death is simply not true. Mm-hmm. And that is the mislead. That paper was so misleading.
Scaremongering, even.
It was. Those were absolute scaremongering with no qualification. Mm. Don't worry, don't worry. Oh. So, can I develop this? Mm. So, in individual terms, okay, so you say worst case scenario is an extra 1 in 50 chance of getting breast cancer over 50 years, over 10 years. One. The treatment of breast cancer is so good today that something like 75% to 90 in that region, depending on the grade of malignancy, are effectively cured as will live for 20 years. Mm. So it's not deaths from breast cancer, it's incidence, most of which will be cured. And then these are single issue fanaticism here. Mm. There's more to life. Women are more than the, I personally think women are more than the sum of their breasts. Mm. And the idea that breast cancer is the totality of women's health, it is not. Mm. And this is what really, can I use a word like pisses me off?
Yeah. On here you go.
The idea is that single issue, that women should be worried about breast cancer. Breast cancer is now the seventh in the rank of causes of death. It's number seven, not number one. You're much, much more likely to die of dementia, cardiovascular disease, osteoporosis. Mm-hmm. Now, HRT protects you against those. So the very things which are common, the commonest causes of death, are protected by HRT. And here we are obsessing over the incidence of the breast cancer. And compared with obesity, obesity is a much greater risk.
Mm-hmm. And it's true, and, you know, getting a bit personal and down on myself, you know, I am overweight at the moment because of, you know, what I've been through with my own hysterectomy and my menopause journey. And yet it would never actually enter my head, you know, oh, actually, I've got to do something. Well, it does now. Got to do something. I've got to do something about this because, this is far worse than being on HRT. And yet, why is it? I mean, do we blame the media? Do we blame all these sort of, as you like to call them, the pink parade?
I blame the pink lobby.
Who are the pink lobby? They were the women that go out running and raise money for breast cancer.
They obsess about breast cancer, and the only thing they can offer, we'll come on to screening and breast self-examine in a minute. Yeah. The only things they offer are the things which are unproven, and that's why I.
What do we do?
Well, everyone's got to examine their breasts and everyone's got to have screening. And we'll come on to that in a minute.
Yeah.
They're partly to blame, but they're fed the wrong message.
Yeah. You
know? Most of them do it in good faith, but they're being fed the wrong message and they don't have the
What is the message they're being fed?
The problem with the message is it's taken me a whole book to try.
Very good way of getting to talk about the book. Which we never mind.
We'll come on to that. I tell you what provoked me to write this book. I once went to Belfast. I used to go regularly to examine. And as you come into Belfast from the after you got off the plane or train, on a wall is a graffiti. Anyone who thinks they can explain the Irish situation doesn't understand it. And that applies to breast cancer. Fantastic. Anyone who thinks they can explain it doesn't understand it. Mm. It's a very, very complex issue.
Oh.
Now, there's an old saying, for every complex problem, there is a simple answer, which is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And now this brings us on to catch it early, quote unquote.
Oh.
Which is what I want to talk to you about, because, you know, most women, you know, and including me, if, you know, you weren't my father, would assume that if there's something out there called screening, which is an X-ray, basically, if you find it, you go for your screening, surely you'll find your breast cancer and then you'll have caught it early and therefore you're being wise and clever and doing something about it.
I was thinking of starting to be screened once a year because, you know, I'm getting to that age and people, you know, I mean, people are saying, you know, can you tell us why it's not a good idea?
Yes, well, listen carefully and I'll try and make it simple. It is a compelling argument that big cancers kill you, small cancers don't, quote unquote. Therefore, catching it early will save lives. In good faith, in 1988, I opened the first screening unit in the southeast of England. Based on the available evidence, it looked as if mammographic screening would save breasts and save lives. And that is the message which most people believe today. And remember, I'm an architect of it. I set up one of the first three units in the country. And we are very proud of what we achieved. Now, as a scientist, I know if the evidence changes, you must change your mind. And the evidence has changed. And I'm trying to think of a simple way of explaining it. You screen at intervals, 3 years in this country, 2 years in another country. But that means you're picking up the slow-growing tumours. The fast-growing tumours, the dangerous ones, will slip through the net.
Why?
Because they grow fast. They grow from a size which may be detected at mammogram to a clinical size within a few months.
But won't we be able to feel those?
And when you feel them, that yes.
They're already big.
So the whole point of screening is to be able to find something less than a centimetre.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the fast-growing... And I ask my students this. If you've got a 1 centimetre tumour in your breast, would you rather it was 6 weeks old or 6 years old?
6 years old.
Yes, that's around. The right answer is 6 years old. So lay women understand this. It isn't hocus-pocus scientific obfuscation. It really can be explained. You want a slow-growing tumour, not a fast-growing tumour. Screening is good at picking out the good cancers, which aren't going to kill you in the first place, but is no good at catching, quote-unquote, the fast-growing tumours. Otherwise, it becomes reductio ad absurdum. Should we have that annual screening? Should we have 6 months screening? It is simply not the answer. That's part one. Part two, what we had never predicted at the time would be overdiagnosis. Mm. Now, overdiagnosis means picking up stuff that looks like a cancer under the microscope, but is not programmed to progress to threaten a woman's life.
Mm-hmm.
So this, if we knew in advance what it is behaviour, we would know not to treat, because treatment for cancer is toxic and dangerous: surgery, radiotherapy, chemotherapy, tamoxifen, all of which have their problem. About at least 30% of cancers detected at screening, we now know, are overdiagnosed.
Or so does that mean they're benign?
Well, no, they look under the microscope like cancer, but they're not programmed to behave. So the idea, we define what is a cancer by the microscopic appearance of a lump that has appeared. And we assume that anything that looks like that, which is subclinical, is going to behave like that. but it doesn't. Mm-hmm. Now, how we know this is technical and complex. I don't want to go into that. But it is now, I am not a maverick. The number of times I have to say this is now the received wisdom.
So is it wasting money, time, resources, worrying people?
Well, if you, just to prove that I'm not a maverick, I've got the current issue of the BMJ.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Saying personalised risk-based screening, and I'll come to this in a minute, why we should be personalising it, coming back to personalisation, and the latest issue, the Which magazine, saying the same thing.
What does personalised mean? We should be completely doing it ourselves. Right.
No. What it means is, if you... As we're doing at the moment, screening
yesterday, last night, I just looked in the mirror and I felt underwhelmed.
Oh, no, that's self-examination. We're not talking about self-examination. I'll come back to that.
Oh,
yeah. Okay. No, we're talking about mammographic mammographic screening. And what we couldn't have predicted, that 30% or more would be overdiagnosed, and that would lead to overtreatment, and you would get rare deaths from over-treatment. It ends up as a zero-sum gain. By that I mean, for every breast cancer death avoided, and it's about 1 in 2,000, for every one breast cancer death avoided, there's one extra death from the over-treatment.
Wow.
And so it's a zero-sum game. That's published. Again, I'm not a maverick. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's published. Mm. Now, all of us, experts like us, are putting our heads together. What can we do? And this is effectively what this paper in the current issue of the BMJ is saying. Mm. We should do risk assessment, risk management. Mm. Now, I do recommend a triage. That means divide women into three.
Mm-hmm.
There are those with a very high risk, where it's estimated about 1 in 8 risk. You don't do mammogram screening, you do genetic screening.
Mm-hmm.
So that group may have a genetic mutation. And so they need guidance to go to a geneticist, family history, and other factors. Very high risk, go for genetic screening. Low risk, which is more than half, would be considered. You've got more important things to think about. Don't forget about breast cancer. Just be careful about dementia, cardiovascular disease, osteoporosis. They're far more important than your risk of breast. Then there must be a group in the middle where the benefits outweigh the harm.
Mm-hmm.
So I would estimate that if you've got a risk of, say, 3 times the average, that's about the threshold where you should be having mammographic screening. I think lay people will respect that and understand that.
I understand, but I want to know how I know I'm in a risk group or not.
Okay, risk factors. Most important, woman. Now, that's not facetious because men get breast cancer. Yeah. Women are 100 times more likely to get breast cancer. Secondly, age. It's a question of age. Can I ask you your age? Would that be
56?
You can't be 56. Yeah. You're kidding.
No.
She looks amazing.
See, this young lady in front of me claims that she's 56. Don't believe it. Okay, you're 56.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
That's the next thing. You're not obese. That's so that's not a worry. Do you have a family history
of
breast cancer?
My mother's had breast cancer. She was on HRT till she was 70.
Put the HRT on one side.
My mum's had breast cancer.
At what age was she?
About 76.
All right. So a single first-degree relative getting breast cancer at the age of 76 doesn't count as a family history.
Okay.
If your mother had got breast cancer to premenopausal age, if there are 2 first-degree relatives, then you would be at risk. Now, there's an algorithm for this. Again, women can check themselves. You go online and there is an algorithm. I used to sit at my desk with my patients with a computer on and do this with them and tick, 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 and come out and say, well, your risk is very low or your risk is very high. So it's quite easy for the
very quickly.
Very. We've done it.
But wouldn't it be more sensible if when women get their screening letters through the post, you know, when they're 50 or whatever, that actually instead of being just called for screening, they actually go to their doctor and discuss whether they are a risk factor.
That's a brilliant idea.
That is the answer, because it is not a summons. Mm. Most women get a letter from the NHS, it's your turn for come to screening. Yeah. So, well, NHS knows best. Well, NHS is speaking on behalf of the herd, the whole population, not the individual. Mm. Yeah. And it is not a summons, it's an invitation, and you should go to your GP and say, should I accept this invitation? Mm-hmm. And I would hope the GPs are equipped. If they're not equipped, or if they'd rather not take it on, then they should refer them to the breast clinic. Every neighbourhood hospital has a breast clinic, and that's the that I used to do that, and I was delighted.
But that letter, you've spent years trying to get a sort of an appendix added to that letter.
We a large group of us. It's not just me. I'm not a maverick. It's just
not just Mike the Maverick.
It's not Mike the Maverick. I'm just very outspoken. That's the difference.
Good on you. We love it.
That's why I'm like I am.
We spent a decade to get them to change the invitation letter. So it wasn't it was coercion.
Well, people feel if they don't go that they are risking their lives.
I just think of Jay Goody, you know. I just think of things like that. You know, I just think, oh, she didn't go for her cervical.
Yeah.
You know, but I get an invitation to do something, I just think, got to go.
But Jay Goody, who I didn't know her, but I had enormous affection for her. Mm. She was kind of a loser, and I thought, breaks my heart.
British people love that.
Yeah, breaks my heart. But she was too young. In any case, she was too young.
Yeah.
So you can't really make anything out of that.
Then I do have a very good friend that died of breast cancer last year. She was only 53, but it was very, very aggressive.
Yeah. So what you can't change is your personal risk, and you can't, it's out of, with your capacity to do anything about the aggressiveness of the cancer. It comes back to, would you rather it was 6 years old or 6 weeks old? You have no control on that, neither do we.
I know women will say, well, I've asked you this before, well, what should I be doing then?
Okay, I'm often asked, and my quick answer, which sounds good, and I'll qualify it immediately, is who says you have to do anything? Who says you've got to do anything? Okay, now, the longer answer is more complex. We are where we are. Breast cancer is the story of the month. And more women grossly overestimate their risk of breast cancer, and women grossly overestimate their risk of dying of breast cancer comparing with all other things. So the message I'm trying to get across is, number one, consider the totality of your health, not single issue. We'll come back to breast cancer in a moment. The most common cause of death may surprise you is dementia. Well, is there anything I can do to protect against dementia? It's difficult to know with certainty, but certainly keeping your brain active, doing Sudoku, playing bridge, going out more, meeting people. Activity, intellectual activity protects. The other thing that protects is HRT.
Wow.
Dementia.
Wow.
Next is cardiovascular disease. Mm. There's so much women can do to reduce their risk of cardiovascular disease. Don't smoke, number one. Stop smoking. Keep your weight down. And HRT is quite good for you.
I love it.
Now, the next is respiratory disease, dying of a respiratory disease. Now, lung disease. Mm. Now, what people overlook is the commonest cause amongst women for dying of lung disease is a pathological fracture due to osteoporosis.
Wow.
If you break your hip, if you you're confined to bed and you're elderly, then you have a high chance of getting pneumonia.
Wow.
So that is the next
thing. So loads of walking,
And HRT.
That's the point. This is the point.
And then, okay, then we'll consider breast cancer and what can you do reducing your risk of breast cancer. Take lots of exercise, keep your weight down, watch your diet, all the things which also protect you against cardiovascular disease. So the very activity for protecting yourself against cardiovascular disease also reduces your risk of breast cancer.
Brilliant.
So there's a lot of people who will be, I'm anti-taking hormones, anti-HRT, but from what you're saying, it sounds to me like it's almost more beneficial to be on it than not to be on it.
Right. Just two things to begin with. People say it's not natural to take HRT. That's the first thing.
Yeah.
And to which I argue, it's not natural for women to live over 50.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
It's well, we died at 56 and we had menopause a year before.
100 years ago, women weren't living over the age of 50. So you could say, according to evolutionary pressure, women were useless beyond the age of childbearing. So, okay. It is not unnatural. It's wonderful that women are living beyond 50. So it's a good thing that women are postmenopausal. That's number one. The other one is the obsession that estrogen causes cancer, breast cancer. It doesn't. And the most striking thing to tell you is before tamoxifen came along, and I was practicing before that period, for advanced breast cancer, we gave high doses of estrogen.
Wow.
And the cancer melted away.
God.
If you look at the incidence of breast cancer and estrogen in the blood, it's the reverse. The greater the risk of getting breast cancer is the older you get, and the estrogen levels are the lowest. Estrogen levels are the highest during pregnancy. You would think, therefore, breast cancer during pregnancy would be a fatal thing. Yeah, but it doesn't. The prognosis of breast cancer during pregnancy is good, better. So there is no good data. And then you come back to what I said, but what about anti-estrogens? Tamoxifen is an anti-estrogen. Well, it's not. It's not an anti-estrogen, it's actually an estrogen.
Wow.
The most important side effect of tamoxifen is endometrial cancer, which is not dangerous. I mean, most are cured. Now, endometrial cancer is a result of estrogenic stimulation. So tamoxifen protects against osteoporosis.
Wow.
Tamoxifen is an estrogen. Now, if you then say, well, can you explain all this? I would say, how long have you got? And this is part of the mystery. It's in the book. Part of the mystery that I'm talking about. So estrogen doesn't cause breast cancer. The increased hazard of breast cancer is the combined hormone replacement therapy, progesterone plus estrogen. Estrogen replacement therapy alone is probably protects you against breast cancer. In fact, the most of the trials show a significant reduction in the risk of breast cancer on estrogen alone. But if it's combined HRT, yes, there is a small increase.
But so why do we have combined then? Because I'm on combined patch.
Okay, because of the estrogenic effect on the endometrium.
You see, I've had a hysterectomy, so I don't. My womb has gone. The progesterone protects the womb because. So I'm only on estrogen. But for women who have a womb, they need it to protect the endometrial lining.
But I've even been sufficiently provocative. It's not that I need to be provocative. But one of the most provocative things I've said: if you're worried about HRT and breast cancer, then why don't you take estrogen replacement therapy alone? Oh, but they may get endometrial cancer. Yeah, but endometrial cancer is always cured.
And also we've had women on, a lot of women on the group who are suffering terribly, you know, with their breast cancer treatment, and they're having the menopausal hot flushes and everything that goes with it. And, you know, and some Kirsty Lang has spoken about this before, yes. You know, at our event last year. So for I want to talk about your book next, like literally next, but just quickly, you know, tell people who have breast cancer or have had it, is it safe for them to consider HRT?
This is where they need counselling. This is where it gets difficult, because we start running out of evidence. But the principle I adopt, when you start run out of evidence, you deal with the problem in front of you. It's just an attitude to life. Yeah. You deal with the problem in front of you. Here you have a woman who's suffering intolerably. Now, I know what I'm talking about, because I've been treating, I no longer have a clinic, but I'm treating breast cancer for 30, 40 years. And I saw many of these women, desperation, life wasn't worth living.
Often suicidal.
Yeah, men out there don't realise what these women are going through. Yeah. And all this talk, I get some of the worst misogynists are women, actually. Senior medical people are being told, oh, it's merely a transition, get used to it. Well, no, I won't get used to it. You see women suffering. I say, look, estrogen replacement therapy will make you feel better overnight. The hazard of that is probably, I'm unaware of any evidence that it will increase your risk of the cancer coming back. So, we'll monitor you.
Get on it.
And they come back a month. Oh, thank you, Professor. My life has changed.
Fabulous.
And Katie can confirm that.
HRT.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm on HRT. I mean, I said, you know, that's why I started the group, because, you know, everyone knows my story, 4 years of perimenopause, misdiagnosed as depression. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, Dad told me that this is more likely to be your hormones.
Yeah.
And HRT has completely transformed my life. But what Dad's referring to is Diane Danzibrink was counselling a woman with breast cancer who had become suicidal. And Diane said, I don't know what else I can do. Can I put her in touch with your father? And, you know, Dad, we put Dad in touch with her, and they discussed, the pros and cons, and obviously he'd sort of spoken to her oncologist and her surgeon, and we asked Dr. Louise Newson if she would also see her, because no one would take that risk of actually making that decision.
Well, I can't. I'm retired. I can't give any individual advice. It would be unethical.
But actually, Louise met with her immediately, which was amazing, and she's now on HRT, and her life has been transformed. I mean, she basically said between the four of us, we've saved her life. As Dad says, sounds terrible, but risk of suicide was 100%. Risk of her breast cancer coming back was...
So why, when my mum got cancer in her 70s, did they take her off HRT immediately, and she got the menopause and felt terrible? You know, why did they take her off it?
At the time, that was the received wisdom. Okay. And the problem is the estrogen breast cancer nexus, I think, is very, very complex. And that's part one chapter on my book. And I end that chapter, if I remember, explaining the complexity of it all. And then the last sentence is... join my world, you know, my world of uncertainty, and you know, kind of join me in this.
So just talk us through very quickly the book. You know, where does it start, and where does it go? I mean, is it written for academics or for the layperson?
The problem with my book is it's written for the intelligent layperson. But it's published by an academic publisher. It's a hardback.
It's beautiful, by the way.
It's got a beautiful cover. Mm. It's published by Cambridge Scholar. So it is priced at an academic hardback, which is too expensive. Mm. But this month, Breast Cancer Awareness Month, they're giving a 50% discount.
Oh,
so if you go online to Cambridge Scholars, and you'll see a whole blurb. This is the book of the month on Cambridge Scholars. There's a whole blurb, and there is a code And you can order the book, quote the code, and you get a 50% discount. Mm.
Fantastic. Now, anyway, let's talk about the book. Yeah.
Well, the book, the idea is to gently to take women through step by step, not as if I was starting with a first-year medical student, and gradually get to the complex thing. And in fact...
Yes, I'm very interested in... I mean, I love history, so I'd be very interested in reading about how, you know, people dealt with it in the olden days.
Well, the easiest chapter to follow, because it's in a sick way it's entertaining, is the history of breast cancer, which is part two. Starting from...
when were they first aware of it?
Ancient Egypt.
Wow, that's amazing. Yeah. We've been going that long, baby.
And there's a famous papyrus, which is in the Chicago Museum of Art, which is a medical papyrus. And there's a passage in that. I think there's even a picture in the book of this... medical papyrus, which says if you have a hot bulging tumour of the breast, cut it. If you have a cold bulging tumour of the breast, do not cut it, you'll make it worse. Simple translation.
Distinguish... Going back to what you believe as well.
It's the hot bulging tumour is the abscess.
Wow.
So you cut a hot bulging tumour, let the pus out, and if it's a cold bulging tumour, whatever that you do, leave it alone. So that was the first...
Fascinating.
But the history is quite extraordinary. But before I get into the history, in a prologue, I talk about my family history and what really involved me. And then the first chapter is entitled The Beauty of Nature and the Nature of Beauty. And I explain the evolutionary advantage of external and internal beauty. And external and internal beauty is based on fractal images.
So is that inside a breast then?
That's a tree.
Okay, I thought I imagined an inside of a breast.
And it is the inside. You got it in one.
Yeah. It looks like broccoli.
Yeah. The best illustration of the interior of the breast is broccoli. It's my favourite.
Broccoli.
It's my favourite. Whenever my wife serves me broccoli, I slice it through the middle and I gaze at it. I say, this is the most perfectly formed breast.
So all women have a pair of trees or broccoli on them.
And dad's surname, well, my maiden name was Baum. German for tree.
Yeah.
Oh,
but in fact, it's not a single tree, it's a copse, because they're 12 trunks. And each trunk is in itself a tree. So you've got 12. And these trees in premenopausal period, they go through the cycle of the year. So they flower, you get a spring and a summer and an autumn and a winter of these trees during the menstrual cycle. And then in the postmenopausal years, it's permanent winter. Now, I use this, because it illustrates what's going on, and also it's to capture attention. I confess, trying to capture attention. So I start off with the internal beauty of the organ, and we all can agree on the external beauty, but what fascinates me is the internal beauty of the organ, and how... The cancer develops by destroying the internal beauty. And I use the analogy of my willow trees. And there's a bit about why does a weeping willow weep? And I've got two willow trees in my front garden. One is the weeping willow and the other is the tortuosa, the ugly one. And it's one gene turns the beautiful fractal geometry of the weeping willow to an ugly mess. And that is exactly what happens, how the genetic mutation that's linked to breast cancer destroys the internal symmetry, the internal beauty. And this is published stuff I'm talking about, published in the New England
Journal. But it means that we are nature, which I love.
We are very much part of nature. Yeah. We have evolved in the same way that the tree has evolved. Yeah.
I love
And that's the start. Mm. And it's very, very beautiful. Basic.
Yeah, but it's beautiful, I think.
Well, I think the analogy. It's beautiful. Then we go on to the history. Mm. And then having, I hope, captured your attention, the difficult stuff.
Yeah.
The idea, it is a complex problem. There are no simple solutions. If you can explain breast cancer, you don't understand it.
Wonderful.
And I think that's a really good, we obviously need to wrap up. We could talk for hours, but we really could. But if you could give a sort of a take-home positive message, if you like, for women, what would it be?
Well, the take-home message is thanks for science, thanks for the clinical trialists, and thanks for all the women who volunteered for clinical trials. The majority of breast cancers are now cured. And that's why it's sunk to seventh in the league amongst all the other things. That's the good news. And consider your totality of your health, not focus just on breast cancer.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Dad, for coming in.
It's been a complete thrill to meet you. And I just feel so knowledgeable now. I'm really like, so I want to go and tell the world,
We're finished now.
No, yeah.
The thing is, what you've just said is true. If you stop patronising women and tell them the truth, they understand it, They grasp it. I lectured, there's an activist group in America called it's the biggest women's activist group. They get it.
Yeah, why shouldn't any woman get it?
Why shouldn't they get it?
Yeah.
And to keep selling them these simple solutions to complex problems, exactly. It's an insult.
Exactly, and your book is beautiful and I'm looking forward to buying it. Thank you so much, Professor Michael Baum.
Baum.
Yeah, we'll pronounce it
differently. Yeah, absolutely.
So what's happening in the Latte Lounge then?
Well, this week is really, really busy. We had our Facebook Live, as I said, last night. Tomorrow, I'm actually going with Diane Danzibrink back to Westminster. We've got an event.
You're going to Westminster?
We've got an all-party event to celebrate World Menopause Day.
Fabulous.
Which we'll report back on.
Yeah.
And what else are we doing? And then Friday, Dr. Newson is hosting an event in her clinic in Stratford, and she's very kindly asked me to be on the panel with lots of fantastic speakers, including Meg Matthews. And
it's so beautiful because, like, the story of your grandmother, who sadly you probably didn't know very well because you were really young.
Yeah.
But it's like, has brought you to this.
Well, the thing
it's
that
an
makes
amazing
me,
circle, isn't
I have
it?
To say, the thing that makes me smile the most is I was rubbish at chemistry and Dad got me a chemistry tutor and I couldn't understand it. And I felt for a long time I was a frustrated...
Lacking.
Well, I was a frustrated nurse/doctor and I thought I can never make people better like he has because I just don't have... My brain's not wired that way. Yeah. But my brain is wired in a more... Dad's an artist. My mum's an amazing writer.
You're a people person. You're a communicator.
Creative. Yeah. I've always been looking for my purpose in life. Mm. And other than having my four wonderful kids, I've finally found my purpose that I can use my kind of creative and marketing skills to almost take Dad's message. And
communication
communicate
skills.
It.
That's what you've got most. And you're bringing people together.
People together and giving them the simple messages, diffusing the complication around terminology. And I can carry his baton now by using this platform to raise money for cancer research so that, I'm doing my little bit,
So the Latte Lounge is fulfilling everybody, isn't it?
Well, I hope so.
So you've got loads coming up.
Yes.
And it sounds really thrilling and I'm really chuffed for you.
Thank you, Josephine.
Anything else that's happening that you want to just put in?
Well, I'm after this week, I'm going to have a little bit of downtime to. It's been a really crazy month, so I will obviously tell you when we next meet. Yes.
Great. Katie, Mike, we've just had the most fun day. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, Josephine. It's been great.